You are listening to Attention, the audio journal for architecture. This is issue number 8, talking about my generation. Interviews were conducted by Joseph Bedford between 2021 and 2022. I'm Tim Cox, the guest editor and narrator for the issue. This is episode number 3, genealogy. Throughout this episode, we'll trace the genealogies of this generation, the pedagogical family trees from which this grouping of U.S. academic architects has emerged, the offices they worked for, their geographic movement across the U.S. through academia, and their responses to the post-critical or projective moment. Broadly speaking, most architects in this group emerged from a set of top-ranked schools of architecture across the East and West Coasts with a suite of shared teachers and employers. Those schools, as we will hear, were places in which an older tradition of disciplinary discourse stemming from Peter Eisenman continued to thrive through the 2000s, at which point the post-critical or projective debate aimed to move the discipline past the Eisenmanian model. Similar to their rejection of generational labels, this cohort did not identify with disciplinary parents or specific lineages of academic architects, and preferred to emphasize a plurality of influences. As Ashley Bingham put it,
genealogies are sometimes a way to reinforce those systems of power. That said, everyone has one. Everyone has a genealogy. Everyone has influences. It's been important for us to distinguish and never solely fit into a single genealogy, that always kind of be working in and out of different worlds or spheres of architecture, because I think it's just very, very difficult if you're so embedded in a particular line of the discipline. I find it very constraining, actually. Intellectually, you know, as a creative practice, you need to be able to take risks and not worry so much about what your former professors would think of you, you know?
Despite this, the development and history of this generation is tied up with a small number of competitive private architecture schools, which both Jerome Hafford and Kyle Miller identified. They each have a slightly different list of schools that come to mind, but the number is, as Kyle points out, no more than 10.
Most of the people who I've listed today and who I think about most frequently graduated from one of 5 schools: GSD, Princeton, Yale, SIARC, and UCLA. Every now and then you'll have bursts of graduates that become leaders in the field from places like Rice or SIARC or Penn, Berkeley. But even then, the list is still, you know, less than 10. I think it's a number of things. It has to do with inequity when it comes to access to higher education, and then renders the practice in this form as rather exclusive to those with the means to be able to participate. But I think on the other end, that's not 100% exclusive. There are people that come from other schools that have inserted themselves into the scene because of their sheer talent and will.
I think it's almost easier thinking about the academies that are producing this generation, or at least this subgroup of a generation. It's Yale, it's Harvard, it's Princeton, Michigan, SIARC, UCLA.
The cultural and economic structure that makes these 10 or so schools the focus of architectural discourse is because the U.S. higher education system is structured to concentrate resources in elite institutions, and that those schools can then leverage these resources to develop architecture as an intellectual pursuit detached from market forces. Among these institutions, there was an understanding that East Coast and West Coast architecture schools had different pedagogies, interests, and strengths. But the migration of key figures from New York to LA in the early 2000s, and the movement of graduates from the coasts to Midwestern schools, has watered down these cultural differences. Hans Tursack and Paul Preisner describe a leveling of the field, with each individual school becoming less distinct.
Excellent student work comes from a lot of places now, and that is really interesting. It can be disorienting because we can't talk about a coherent East Coast style a coherent West Coast style, a coherent Midwestern style. I think all of that has eroded pretty dramatically, pretty quickly in the past 5 to 10 years. I think there are brilliant people at a huge range of types of schools, let's say. Large state schools, small private schools, liberal arts schools, tiny liberal arts schools. And that makes for a more exciting conversation. It might be disorienting using our older metrics. I don't think those metrics apply anymore.
When I was in school, it seemed much clearer that there were schools of architecture, and those were different depending on the institution and the country that that institution took place. And I don't think those differences exist so much anymore. I think schools are all largely the same. I think there's internal arguments how they're all different, but as somebody who, through Instagram and being on reviews at different schools, the work looks nearly identical in all the important ways and seems only different in the superficial ways.
However, across the series of interviews, many respondents still used East Coast and West Coast as meaningful terms, even if they are anachronisms, both for describing the output of their differently schooled colleagues and to understand their own educational experience. Here's Mira Henry and Kyle Miller glossing the East-West divide.
The whole culture of the West Coast, you know, certainly in architecture, is the maverick kind of space. You know, we're thinking about fabrication and things that are, you know, relating to all kinds of industries. So it was always kind of air of like, figure it out on your own energy a little bit.
I think on the West Coast, there's just much more of a casual relationship with theory and history and scholarship, and a more, let's just say, a higher capability to produce more visually dynamic and seemingly progressive and novel aesthetics. I have zero doubt that some of the most compelling visuals come from SciArc today.
And here's Michael Young, reflecting on his time studying at Cal Poly.
We didn't spend a whole lot of time in undergraduate school talking about who our most important presidents were or how we situated ourselves within a sort of lineage. We understood that we were operating as postmodern, and at some level we were definitely not doing modernism. We knew that. We also knew we were not doing the kind of postmodernism of Michael Graves and the Grays of the 1970s. But I don't remember spending much time in undergraduate school talking about Peter Eisenman or John Haydock or any of that other sort of more East Coast discourse. What we were looking at, Morphosis and Coop Himmelblau and Stephen Hall and Antoine Prédoc, and then towards the end, Herzog Dimeron.
Next, we'll turn towards a set of influential educators that this generation repeatedly referred to as having shaped their trajectories. On the East Coast, there was Peter Eisenman, who taught at Yale, as well as Pierre Vittorio Orelli, Peggy Diemer, Keller Easterling, and Stan Allen, who was the dean at Princeton between 2002 and 2012. On the West Coast, there was Sylvia Lavin, Jason Payne, and Bob Sommel. Though in the latter case, Sommel also taught at Princeton and became dean at UIC in the Midwest later on. And finally, Sarah Whiting and Jeff Kipnis both moved between the middle of the country and the coasts. Sarah Whiting taught alongside Stan Allen in the early part of his deanship, before becoming the dean of Rice and now the dean of Harvard. And while Kipnis was largely based at OSU, he also taught at UCLA and Princeton. There were many other figures that were named across the interviews, but this list accounts for those who were mentioned by more than one interviewee. Rather than account for who bumped into who, we hope to offer a clear picture of the shared intellectual inheritance of this generation, and to begin to understand their practices as participating in the interconnected discourses between these figures. Let's start with Peter Eisenman. It would be difficult to oversell Eisenman's impact on architectural pedagogy, and his presence as a disciplinary father figure was felt by the interviewees. Eisenman focused heavily on debate throughout his career, from the journal Oppositions, which emphasized differences between groups like the Whites and the Grays, or produced high-profile debates between Eisenman and Christopher Alexander or Leon Krier. Known for his arguments around disciplinary autonomy and his argumentative approach to teaching architecture, frequent comments throughout the interviews seem to reference him when they speak against an insular architectural culture, an approach to ideology that comes from conflict and the formation of clear camps, or a belief in the need to form strong arguments. Here's Paul Preisner on the culture of Eisenman's office.
I worked at Peter Eisenman's office before I started grad school, and then was in school there. And while I was in school, I worked at Philip Johnson's office during school. And then when I graduated, I went back full-time at Peter's office for a couple of years until summer of 2001 when I left and moved back to New York. And so I think, you know, that office was important, you know, because it was it seemed like an important office. I was interested in his work and projects, and I think it was a kind of really weird studio to be in because it was kind of run the same way school studios were. So it was chaotic and messy, and hierarchies weren't really there. Everybody did everything, and everybody got yelled at equally, it seemed at. But also, everybody would get supported equally if they did something that Peter found worth being interested in.
Here's Kyle Schumann on observing Eisenman's influence on members of this cohort.
Places like Princeton, where you have Eisenman and Graves, and I think there are like some maybe more theoretical ideas, like maybe from the Eisenman side, that I think you can maybe identify some of those sort of topics or desires in the work emerging, even with people like Michael Meredith, that then sort of course, trickle down to the next generations.
Here's Michael Young on his relationship to Peter Eisenman, as well as the moment that Eisenman discovered Pier Vittorio Arelli, which exemplifies Eisenman's strategy of embracing new developments in the discipline.
I would become his teaching assistant at Yale, in which he discovered this young writer, Pier Vittorio Arelli, who had sent him a Xerox copy of his dissertation. And Peter essentially said, "We're not doing what we thought we were going to do anymore. We're going to do this now." I think Peter's been pretty interesting throughout his career in just radically shifting gears when he realizes a certain project has kind of run its course and something else needs to happen. And even if he doesn't know exactly how to do it or process it at first, he's usually pretty right on in recognizing the need to do so.
And McLean Clutter, reflecting on the same Eisenman studio at Yale.
It was a studio where Peter Eisenman decided he would teach a studio on Arelli's project. And I think you can publish this because I think Peter said it out loud, but it was kind of a disaster. Or at least he thought it was, and it didn't produce what he wanted to. So that was just kind of nascent in the school.
The presence of Eisenman is felt in this generation through their rejection of his pedagogy and architectural project. Brittany Udding also recalls the importance of Eisenman's Arelli studio and the shift that it signaled towards a new kind of aesthetics and a new kind of political discourse in architecture.
We sort of started off with formal analysis, with understanding architecture through its own sort of autonomous disciplinary project, through obviously Peter Eisenman's formal analysis pedagogy and methods. And we ended grad school with Pier Vittorio Arelli, where it was a kind of a profound way of looking at architecture as something that's deeply embedded in the politics of the built environment and the kind of importance of housing, the importance of domestic space, the importance of using architecture to imagine a new form of collective life for the city. That was sort of how we bookended our grad schools.
Neron Turan, who also studied at Yale, recounts the novelty of Arelli's project.
I did encounter the work of Pier Vittorio Arelli, who visited Harvard GST. It might be his first American lecture, I'm not sure. This should be 2009 or something. And I was stunned. Like, I saw someone coming in with a kind of urban background and interest and making all the arguments to architecture. I was like, what is this? I couldn't classify it.
And Brittany Udding again.
Dogma's work as a rejection of the parametric, of the swoops. I think that that was an important disciplinary shift. I think that also when we were at school, Peggy Diemer was in the process of forming the architecture lobby. You know, Keller Easterling was writing about, she had just sort of published her book, Extra Statecraft, when we were there. Dolores Hayden's work on the kind of the role of domesticity of feminist materialist praxis was also really in the air. And I think that that produced a really interesting confluence of voices that were, it was a moment when I think architects were sort of re-examining the role of the city and the other sort of regulatory, environmental, and economic systems that produced architectural form.
Peggy Diemer and Keller Easterling were a pair of influential educators at Yale who are notable for their attempts to approach the question of politics in architecture through new channels. Easterling developed a body of critical work that challenged the way that architecture has become an instrument in global flows of capital. And Peggy Diemer founded the Architecture Lobby to organize for better labor conditions in architecture. Both Neron Turan and McLean Clutter cited Diemer and Easterling as key influences on their work and politics.
At Yale, I studied with Keller Easterling, so I think she has a very big influence on me. At the time, I think Peggy Diemer was very involved in the program that I was in, and I think those two had an impact on me. Their positions were slightly maybe different or complementary, but I think Peggy at the time, the whole work on labor was not there yet. This should be, so this was between 2001 and 2003.
For me, the mentor would have been Peggy, but also people in my orbit were Keller Easterling. Peggy is really where I've, in large part, developed my politics and the way I feel about the profession, and frankly, also my ethical compass as an educator.
Stan Allen was widely credited by many in the group as an important influence. As a writer, Allen wrote persuasively about the relationship between theory and practice, arguing that theory should be understood as born out of the inherent material conditions and intelligence of practice, rather than being imposed from the outside by other discourses. And as an educator, Allen spoke to his students of the way that modes of representation, material behaviors, or techniques of various kinds, contained logics that facilitate architecture's performative effects in the world. Here's Meredith Miller on the role Allen played in transitioning out of an Eisenmanian system of thought.
The conversations that were happening at Princeton had to do with the recognition of a kind of failure that people perceived that architecture's was not quite living up to the challenge of responding to the contemporary city, you know, ecological problems, and that kind of purely formal Eisenman camp of design needed to be rethought. But I think that that came through, there were different responses to that. So I think of Stan Allen as being, you know, pretty influential on me, even though I actually never had him as a professor, just in the way he wrote about architecture's role within urbanism, his thinking on field conditions, and his ability to relate urbanism to design in a way that had a kind of approachable technique. Or there was a way, I think as an educator, he was able to translate those ideas into a method for design. And I think that kind of infiltrated a lot of the pedagogy at Princeton.
And Michael Young sees Allen's influence on the aesthetic output of this cohort, and particularly the shift towards discrete and scattered forms.
We can see the echoes of Stan Allen's field conditions in a lot of the informal scatter plan organizations that would be practiced by a multitude of architects throughout the early parts of the 21st century.
While Eisenman, Arelli, Diemer, Easterling, and Allen were some of the most influential figures on the East Coast, Sylvia Lavin, who served as chair of UCLA's architecture department from 1996 to 2006, was frequently named as one of the most influential figures on the West Coast. She exerted a huge influence through her pedagogical approach during her decade-long tenure. Her chairship coincided with the migration of many educators from Columbia, such as Jason Payne and her life partner, Greg Lynn, and the development of a new conversation around digital design tools that began to encompass more advanced modes of materialization and manufacturing. In her own writings, she spearheaded a debate about the power of architectural affect, as its sensuous material dimensions could seduce and inspire new feelings and emotions, a debate which directly responded to the new manufacturing tools appearing in architecture. She also curated a set of arguments and conversations in the school about many other topics. She brought in Bob Sommel to teach and established a debate between her own discourse of affect, Payne's discourse of sensation, Greg Lynn's discourse of intricacy, and Sommel's discourse of graphic legibility. Here are Andrew Holder, Mira Henry, and Christy Ballier.
I was a graduate student at UCLA 2002 through 2005. Those were almost exactly the last years of Sylvia Lavin's tenure as chair at UCLA. So part of that project, I think, was pretty explicitly a myth that may have some substantial grounding in reality, that a group of people had initiated a certain strand of work really under Bernard Schumi and the first of the paperless studios at Columbia. And that post-Schumi, there was a kind of diaspora of that group. Some remained on the East Coast, but a significant portion moved west. And that movement west coincided with Sylvia's rise to the chair position at UCLA. Many of those characters who had moved west post-Columbia ended up working with her. First among those would be Sylvia's sort of partner in crime and in life, Greg Lynn, but also a whole cast of characters who came with Greg and had some sort of exposure to the system at Columbia. So I'm thinking of people like Jason Payne, David Erdman, and then a whole cast of characters who were kind of sympathetic to that project and already in Los Angeles in one way or another.
I was studying at UCLA in 2008, 2009, 2007, 2008, 2009. Sylvia Lavin was teaching there and influenced my education a lot. Jason Payne, Heather Roberge, these are people who kind of began in many ways, kind of were solidified the sensation project on the heels of a close study of digital fabrication, right? So this was kind of fundamentals of developing an understanding of really very rigorous, let's say, geometric surface modeling, translating into kind of novel tectonics in digital fabrication context. And at the kind of turn from a sort of material as abstract to material as real, form as abstract to form as maybe referential.
There was a group of us that was at UCLA at the time when Sylvia Lavin was the director. And I think that many would attribute her thinking pedagogically at that digital turn as a way not to put technology and design sort of at odds with each other, but instead sort of incorporate design, where I think at a lot of other institutions in the mid-2000s, those things were still very much being separated. Not all directors, you know, they're all useful at institutions, but they're not all so focused on, I think, shifting and supporting a generation. And I think that the moments, the years that Sylvia Lavin was at UCLA, I think it was very, very intentional that she took a firm position on how her school, faculty, and students would traverse that transition from a sort of pre-digital into the digital, and then develop sort of a set of children maybe that went on to, I think, launch into the post-digital.
Jason Payne, as described just a few moments ago, was a key educator at Lavin's UCLA. Payne was one of the first students to graduate from Columbia's paperless studio, and as he developed his own voice, he shaped a new discourse around the necessity for the digital to take on material processes, behaviors, and qualities. Here's Mira Henry on her experience with Payne.
Most people of that generation, particularly at UCLA, would probably point to Jason as one of the biggest influences as a pedagogue at the time. He was an extremely creative educator. and really like introduced quite a bit of new sets of information to be able to read as architecture too, studying closely things that were out in the world rather than necessarily things that were, let's say, in a computer or in a history.
Meredith Miller finds roots for her cohort's interest in materiality through this UCLA lineage.
Jason Payne and Heather Roberge and some of the studios that they were doing then and the kind of, yeah, texture and tactility and rethinking materiality. Yeah, that was definitely something that I saw in my peers' work coming out of UCLA.
Next, we will turn to Bob Sommel, another figure comparable to Sylvia Lavin for this generation. Like Lavin, he entered the field without gaining a design degree or practicing. Instead, with his PhD, he assumed the role of theorist, critic, and design educator. He worked for Peter Eisenman in the 1990s, as Eisenman was incorporating the Deleuzian discourse of matter and sensation into his previously deconstructivist project. But he later, alongside Sarah Whiting, wrote a polemic against Eisenman's critical project, under the umbrella of what he termed the projective. Sommel was developing the idea of the projective and the associated discourses of shape, graphic legibility, and speculative fictions while teaching at UCLA and Princeton in the 2000s, and then as director of UIC in Chicago from 2007 to 2022. Kelly Baer, Jimenez Lai, Cyrus Penarroyo, and Paul Preisner all taught or studied at UIC under Bob Sommel. They described his mode of discourse as dedicated to the formation of arguments, emphasizing the clear adoption of an ideological project and engaging with the question of audience. To this end, he brought different people to the school and encouraged them to take risks that resulted in an ahead-of-the-curve design discourse at UIC.
Bob was the history theory professor at that time, and so you really couldn't get through the gates of UCLA without that kind of introduction to theory that Bob laid out. And in many ways, I think it's interesting that that's where he was at that time, because he would then, and I would say he would still now, as someone that is under his directorship in Chicago, really push back against affect as a and even material as a motivator for architecture. He would definitely err. He would want to shift materiality to materialism and other types of isms.
I was initially introduced to Bob Sommel's work by George Baird. George taught a seminar in Toronto, where I went to school. Originally, I think George's idea was to get the students to read Bob Sommel and Jeff Kipnis and present the counter-argument of what not to do. But I guess I thought the counter-argument was more interesting than the argument. So that's how I got introduced to the writing.
So I arrived at UIC and Bob Sommel, he started my second year there as an undergrad. And so while I was there, the school was kind of changing, like what seemed like month to month. I think he was bringing in a lot of different people. I think the agenda of the school was definitely shifting and sharpening during that period. And, you know, I was very fortunate to get to interact with a lot of really young faculty that were working on really exciting projects and bringing in new ideas. And my final studio professor was Jimenez Lai. And I ended up working with him afterwards on the White Elephant Project, which is one of his kind of early installations. And I feel like that experience was really formative.
He's probably had the most input, not always in a friendly way, but always in a kind of supportive way to make me be more interrogative of what my interests are and to kind of find things that are, you know, to be okay with taking risks of changing things up. And that's, I think, allowed me maybe a personal freedom to explore creativity in ways that weren't always popular or on trend.
The agenda of the school aesthetically clustered around the idea of shape and graphic legibility, which developed to incorporate cartoons in conjunction with the work of Jimenez Lai. Here's Lai, Kyle Reynolds, and McLean Clutter on the aesthetic project at UIC.
I went to Chicago to teach at Bob's school at UIC. Spent 6 years at UIC. I would say six really productive years where I completed my book, Citizens of No Place. Six productive overlap years with Bob, where he was trying to build a school, craft his position.
At my time at UIC, there was definitely the kind of the undercurrent of the projective project, the shape project, the graphic. Menes was there. I was there. Thomas Kelly, Kelly Bear arrived shortly after Stuart Hicks and Allison Neumeier. And so, like, you know, you see this kind of mixing of that set of interests in that place at that time. You know, for me personally, it definitely fed into the work that I was doing.
For Bob, all of that work was really about a kind of legibility for architecture that would be about engagement. I don't know if he would say it necessarily in that way, but about something that's not so hard, that can nominate new audiences, create new audiences, as he used to say, because it has doesn't necessarily rely on prior knowledge. It's more about what it's going to make once it arrives in the world. But it has a kind of, again, a legibility and a kind of pop. And so I think that's where the pop sensibility and the cartoon sensibility also folds in, is in, it's about the audience, and it's about how the architecture is going to make an audience and who it's going to communicate to and collect.
To say the word easy might be, I mean, I feel like easy might be kind of even a clearer word than cartoon. You know, the way that Bob was talking about shapes, silhouette of a skyline or silhouette of building, as though for us to reconnect with the thinkings of John Hiddock, the notion that a building could be a character. I think that was definitely early conversation that Bob wanted to form. I was really taken by it. And I also think this is partially why he, at the time, was interested in bringing me on board.
Sommel was not alone in advancing the project of legibility and graphic expediency in architecture. Sarah Whiting, who co-authored the influential essay Notes on the Doppler Effect, spread similar ideas about the persuasive and organizational effects of figures and geometry in architecture. She spoke of engaged autonomy, which meant using the tools and techniques of architecture's formal language to engage with the world. Like Sommel, Whiting was also an important mentor. She pushed students and faculty alike to define their project. Bryony Roberts reflects on her time studying with Sarah Whiting at Princeton, and then Michelle Chang, who was a Wortham Fellow at Rice, reflects on her experience under Whiting's deanship.
Architecturally, I was educated by people who were claiming a post-critical moment. So it was well after, on the East Coast, the critical theory dominant moment when Eisenman and the Institute were sort of shaping discourse. There was this sort of post-critical reaction to that. And I was a student of, like, Sarah Whiting, who was a major mentor of mine in graduate school and early teaching. And a lot of the other faculty also at Princeton when I was in graduate school, Paul Lewis, Sylvia Lavin, Liz Diller, and Sarah Whiting, they were intentionally kind of shifting attention from the autonomous world of critical theory to engagement with practice and its limitations as being productive, the sort of productive constraints of matter, economy, time, place. And I think that was very profound for me, but I think I've been trying to push that even further to say, yes, let's look at the constraints on practice as productive, but how can that be even more political and even more embodied? So how can we think about the conditions of site with more complexity, thinking about it as a cultural context, a place that's full of social histories, social experiences, but also thinking about those things as not just analytical content, but really embodied experience.
Teaching under Sarah, something that was maybe more of an education that was a little bit more autonomous, started to get a little bit more dirty. Like very slowly, especially when I got to Rice. Yeah, and the idea of the project was very, very heavy, and how to position the project very clearly in a way that you can summarize it became an exercise that I got used to. Being a lecturer, I mean, we've all sort of felt this, right? Nobody even is like looking at you. You're earning like no money, but you have all these ideas, you're doing all this stuff, and then suddenly Sarah Whiting is editing my syllabi. So like she's looking at basically like a mini paper that I've written about architecture and giving me her thoughts, which is, I think, like just so incredible, right? I think For me, knowing how clear her position is was extremely helpful, but not something that I have as a position myself.
Jeff Kipnis was also a figure that many in the group referred to as important in their education. Kipnis also entered the field without an architectural education and assumed the role of critic, theorist, and educator. He played a central role in the avant-garde debates around Derrida and Deleuze in the 1980s and 1990s, while he was a professor at OSU from 1987 to 2022, he taught and lectured frequently at Princeton, Harvard, Columbia, UCLA, and CSIARC. Kipnis was known for his brazen approach to public discourse. Very much a performer, he was an intense participant in debates and design criticism. Michael Young, Jerome Hafford, and Paul Preisner commented on his widespread influence through the schools in which he taught, his role in advancing the theory of affect and sensation, and Kipnis's strategy of pushing students to form clear positions and arguments.
There's a connection of Jeff Kipnis. There's things that happen that are interesting over time. Like for one reason or another, in the early 2000s, everyone I knew had read some Greg Lynn. Greg Lynn was a fundamental touchstone for everyone. Yet now I don't find people really talking about Greg Lynn, his work or his writing, very often, much less discussed. The same thing with Jeff Kipnis. I think that Jeff Kipnis is a crucial link in so many of these people we're looking at here, both his influence in Ohio, his influence in CSIARC, his influence at Princeton, his influence at the GSD, and then earlier in the AA. I mean, there's all these different trajectories that are kind of funneling through Jeff Kipnis.
As a precocious undergrad, took Jeff Kipnis's seminar. It was usually a graduate seminar, but a few of the precocious undergrads would wander in. And he was kind of working through all of it. This was almost like a seminar was a bit of a playground for him to workshop talks he was giving around the country. We would sort of talk about different emerging architects and artists and also canonic buildings. And so he was sort of working through all of that. I don't think he was pushing super hard the sort of sensual position so much as a student.
At school, when I was at Columbia, I think the kind of most interesting teachers I had Jeff Kipnis for a seminar, who, you know, is kind of a jerk and problematic, but I also loved the class and him and found it really helpful to figure out how you can work through being uncomfortable with a thought or proposition and figure out ways to kind of argue it or really, I guess, interrogate what your own interests might be, right? To not just kind of adopt someone else's practice and advance it, but to figure out what your own inclinations might be and maybe explore those in a way as embarrassing or useless as they might turn out to be.
So far, we've heard about the shared academic influences of this generation. Next, we will turn to OMA and Moss as two key offices which introduced members of this generation to architectural practice. While OMA had become a globally successful practice, it was still known as being a place that encouraged a high degree of speculation and experimentation in the office. Here are Anna Niemark and Andrew Kovacs on the importance that their time at OMA played for them and others in the group.
For me and Jimenez, OMA, the office of OMA, their work and being there was really important, I think, to some degree for Sarah too, you know, but also for others, like people like Lucia LA, you know, it just seems like there are people who work in history today who also went through a kind of educational complex of like the GSD / OMA / Sarah. I think all of that is probably formulated a kind of way of working where those who work in design and those who work in history see an affinity in the ways in which we construct arguments or construct diagrams or construct certain kinds of conceptual affinities, and we're able to actually speak to one another as a result.
When I read the project descriptions of OMA's projects and I saw the projects, it connected in my head more so than any other architect at the time. When I was a fourth year in the five-year program, there was a job posting for OMA New York that was posted on the website ArchiNet. And I applied. I got an interview. I went to the interview. And they asked me when I could start. And I said, right away. And I first met Jimenez at the modeling table at OMA New York. So that's how I became friends and acquaintances with many of these characters that you're referencing. And then, so I did that. I worked there for, and that office, the OMA New York office, became Rex while I was there. And then I moved to Rotterdam to go work at OMA in Rotterdam.
Hilary Sample, the other founding principal of Moss alongside Michael Meredith, also worked at OMA. Moss is another office where employees spend time experimenting and speculating. Sample and Meredith's office is notable for its range of creative endeavors, producing not just drawings and buildings, but objects, books, videos, furniture, and lately, rugs. Here's Jaffer Kolb, Jimenez Lai, Ashley Bingham, and Michelle Chang on the influence of Moss and its culture of thinking freely on their own practices.
There's, of course, the post-Moss tradition, which I have a very intimate relationship with, both because Michael was teaching at Princeton when we were there, but also because Evie, my business partner, obviously worked for Moss for 5 years after we left grad school. And so I think not only in terms of like representation and form, the kind of Moss aesthetics are really embedded in the DNA, both of my generation in general and my peer group, but also very specifically my practice. Michael Meredith told Evie something that has become like a real touchstone for us as an office, which is like, don't overthink anything, make more things, and eventually just like look back on it and try and figure out what the hell you were doing.
I had drawn a lot of cartoons independently throughout my both childhood and also my career as a student. I just drew a lot of cartoons. I just, you know, drew comics. That's just what I did. In fact, in my first year at Mark, when I had a very young Michael Meredith as a professor at the time, he really encouraged me to go with it. This path couldn't have been possible if I didn't meet him that way, if he wasn't so encouraging of the cartoons.
I worked at Moss for a year, actually worked at the firm before I went to grad school. So I think in many ways that was such an eye-opening experience for me to work at a practice where they were really doing lots of speculative projects. They were making films, we were building models, you know, we were doing lots of really experimental work. And obviously I think they've been influences just as kind of models of how to have a thriving practice while keeping it, you know, very much on the kind of cutting edge of the discipline.
Michael Meredith was a very big influence on me. He was my thesis advisor and he taught my studio in the first year and I worked for him. I was a pretty bad employee. I just remember thinking that there was a recipe to school. And if I were to just follow the recipe, then I would do well. I think Michael showed me by pointing out things that he liked, how that was a kind of wrong approach and that there was a lot of freedom.
While we've heard about the influence of key schools, educators, and offices, an important component of the way that this generation understands its own trajectory is in their commingling in the Midwest post-graduation. We will talk about fellowships shortly, but even just the list of those who were educated on the coasts but landed their first non-fellowship teaching position in a Midwestern school is quite long. Christy Ballier, Curtis Roth, Ashley Bingham, and Eric Herman were all hired at OSU. McLean Clutter, Cyrus Penarroyo, and Meredith Miller were all hired at Michigan. And Kelly Baer, Paul Preisner, Stuart Hicks, and Jimenez Lai were all hired at UIC. Many in the group felt that the mixing together of people from different schools at places like Michigan, OSU, and UIC created a fertile ground for the exchange of ideas. They also emphasized the material support that these schools provided them for developing their work. Here's Christy Ballier, Meredith Miller, Kyle Miller, and Kelly Baer on the movement from the coasts to the middle of the country.
East Coast, West Coast debate, early to mid-2000 debate, took its next stage in the Midwest, where those institutions on the East Coast and the West Coast had sort of produced the next generation of junior faculty. And the East and the West Coast, as is still probably the case, are quite dense with faculty and people that have projects and that have pedagogic positions, that oftentimes, or at least at that moment in time, the Midwest was very fertile ground for a place where junior faculty could go to sort of develop that project outside of the umbrella of their graduate institutions.
There was more of a kind of fixed position on either coast. And so I think a lot of us that found ourselves in the Midwest at that very same time, I think felt that we had room to insert a new conversation and form very consciously a new generation of architects that weren't in opposition to the ones that we were trained by, but just had maybe had something else to say.
The East and the West were really always at the forefront, still are, especially from a technological standpoint. And so arriving in the Midwest meant that we could no longer kind of rely on, you know, how contemporary we were based on the technology that we were using. I was kind of put into a much more analog-driven, kind of low-tech driven curriculum than I had come from on the West Coast. And so taking that knowledge and almost reining it back and having to figure out new ways in which to use that knowledge with maybe a different set of means.
What was it about the late 2000s and early 2010s that facilitated this migration of graduates from some of the top coastal schools to the middle of the country at the same time? While the spread of the internet made architectural discourse easier to access from afar, the contracting job market on the coasts seems the most likely explanation. Kyle Miller describes both the leadership decisions and material support for career development that he saw as shaping this Midwestern migration.
It has everything to do with newly appointed leaders at, let's say, four or five of those schools. So Monica coming to Michigan, I think it was 2008 or 9, Michael going to Kentucky in 2008, Bob going to Chicago 2007, I think it was, John McMurrow at Michigan, but also at Ohio State, Kipnis, but I guess he's always kind of been at Ohio State, or he's been there for quite some time. It had everything to do with them, their openness and willingness to kind of sponsor the development of new people, and us buying in to those people. Like, I went to Kentucky. I could have gone to Michigan also. I could have stayed in the Netherlands. I went to Kentucky because I fully believed in how Michael would be someone who could support my personal development and enable my own professional growth in ways that wouldn't happen elsewhere. And I think a lot of people that were teaching, started their teaching careers in the Midwest at that time, felt the same thing, and I think would tell a similar story. There was just room. There was room for us, and there was resources. And now being closer to New York, I see people there, you know, on the adjunct circuit that just don't have the same opportunities that we all had as tenure-track faculty in the Midwest.
And of course, fellowship programs at Michigan, OSU, and Rice were a key draw that brought this generation to the middle of the country and gave them a foothold to work towards tenure-track jobs. A large number of people in this group did fellowships at Michigan, OSU, and Rice. At Michigan, Hans Tursak, David Eskenazi, Clark Tenhaus, Andrew Holder, Kyle Reynolds, Joffer Kolb, Cyrus Penarroyo, Brittany Udding, Ashley Bingham, and Eric Herman. At OSU, there was Jimenez Lai, Curtis Roth, and David Eskenazi. And both Bryony Roberts and Michelle Chang did the Wortham Fellowship at Rice. Michigan was the pioneer in these fellowships, establishing its first teaching fellowship in 1984. The long track record of Michigan's fellowships and the large number of fellowships available currently 5, has made Michigan the most desirable and attractive of them all. But in recent years, many other schools have begun their own fellowships as well, creating something of a fellowship bubble, as some have called it. Rice began its fellowship in 1995. OSU and Buffalo both began their fellowships in 2000. Milwaukee began its fellowship in 2013, Syracuse in 2015, UT Austin 2016, Miami and Kent 2017, Georgia Tech 2018, Oregon and Tennessee 2019, and Virginia Tech in 2022. You can visualize the graph that would plot the growth of these fellowships, as well as noticing that none of the major East and West Coast schools where this generation was chiefly educated are on the list, perhaps not needing fellowships to attract talent. Here's Michael Young, Curtis Roth, Kelly Baer, and Kyle Miller on the significance of teaching fellowships and what they see as driving their popularity, both from the perspective of universities and of potential fellows.
Fellowships for upcoming professors, especially in Michigan and Ohio State, that brought people together. There's a lot of people here who their first initial conversations were occurring through Michigan, through those formats and those fellowships.
The impetus for those fellowships was really an expansion, in my mind, of a whole series of schools, particularly in the Midwest, who were trying to like attract talent from the coasts, was the kind of classic model of starting that. And so it was schools like Ohio State or Michigan or Kent or Cincinnati or whatever, who were like looking, Rice has one as well, but like looking to the coasts and how do you draw talent to Columbus, Ohio, right? So I did a thesis at MIT, and in a way, like doing fellowships after I got out of school became a way to work through some of the issues of that thesis project in the, you know, 2 years afterwards. And I think for a lot of other people, it's similar as a model, right? So it's like, I don't know, it's the kind of extended thesis model.
In our particular late Gen X generation, Christy and I specifically, we're on the older end and we actually missed the fellowship boat. So they, you know, there were some, but they were few and far between, and they weren't nearly as well kind of publicized, nor as funded and also successful in terms of what they produced, who they produced. And so that's kind of been a later thing, I think, that's arrived on the academic scene since we've been tenured, or right about the middle of our tenure track, probably, is when we started to see more of these. And so I think it's been really kind of phenomenal in terms of both setting up someone who's maybe just coming out of thesis to someone that's transitioning into the role of defining their own practice and their own kind of teaching pedagogy. And I think, you know, we can attribute a lot of the successes, I think, that we've seen in this generation to those.
Those fellowships have quite the standing, and I think attract a lot of younger people who often study at more elite institutions because they know it comes with resources and time and space to cultivate an identity. And we have one here now at Syracuse that's been running for 5 years that's becoming like that. I mean, Michigan's, I would say, is the most prolific just because there's 3 spots usually and it's been running for so long.
And here's Clark Tenhouse, Michael Meredith, Joffrey Kolb, Ashley Bingham, and Meredith Miller on what fellowships offer graduates and how they shape career trajectories, particularly in terms of the freedom they grant to develop ideas and the way they promote the mixing of ideas from different schools.
The fellowship offers such an opportunity, especially for people who are getting into teaching. So at that time when I had that fellowship, I had not had, other than RMIT in Melbourne, I didn't have a full-time teaching position. I had taught in LA and I had taught in Denver. You know, so that's one part of it. You know, so people who want to become involved in academia, I think, go after those, but they also actively use those opportunities to cultivate new work. And I think that's what's so beneficial about a fellowship like that, is it's really hard, I think, to find time and resources and support to do work like that, sometimes without a fellowship.
When I graduated, my first teaching job was a fellowship at Michigan, and I was a fabrication expert. So, because I could code G-code for CNC machines. And so that was the beginning of where I started in academia.
I ended up doing this fellowship in Michigan in 2015, and the people I was surrounded by Ellie, Adam, Andrew Holder, all of these people really came out of LA, and then I met a lot of people through them. And of course, disciplinarily, that was a generation that was really interested in formalism, material experimentation, an idea of the kind of cartoonish grotesque, I think, that was really popular in LA in the early 2000s, that was ushered in by people like Greg and Jason and Heather and all of these other people who were there. And these are the people who kind of were like the hinge point that got us into Triple O.
The fellowship at University of Michigan, I think that put us in contact with a lot of people who had grown up, let's say, in the West Coast genealogy. So the kind of Greglin or UCLA SciArc genealogy and all the kind of East Coast educated architects and the West Coast educated architects were meeting in Michigan and working together. And so I think we've talked about that with James Michael Tate, another of our colleagues there who had also gone to Yale. He kind of said, oh, this was our second education where we actually learned from our colleagues instead of professors. And it was the colleagues that had been educated in a different system.
What was striking was the differences in our approaches, the differences in the training that we had received. So Ellie and Adam coming from UCLA, you know, Rosalyn and I coming from Princeton, Tom coming from Yale, Katie Newell coming from Rice, Vivian Lee coming from the GSD. So it's almost like we had this representation of these different pedagogies, and we were all coming and kind of teaching the same studios and the same courses. And so it rendered legible maybe some of the tendencies that we had inherited.
The most dramatic change actually occurred when I was teaching at the University of Michigan. When I went to the University of Michigan as an Oberdick Fellow, you know, I credit that school for really providing time and space and resources to reevaluate the work that I was doing. And so that's really where the shift turned from maybe more of the kind of digital kind of what I was doing in grad school and became, yeah, more invested and interested in history. But there is also a really direct change in, for lack of a better word of saying it, like form making. And that's when I became interested in the geometric primitives and aggregations and things that were sort of nameable as parts, but unnameable as wholes. And I saw that as a way to sort of open up space for associative thinking as opposed to sort of fixed identity.
While fellowships were praised for all of these reasons, for mixing people and ideas and giving opportunities to develop work, they were also subject to criticism from a number of angles, in terms of their low pay and the manner in which they support the adjunctification of faculty, and the recent pressure that's been placed on adjunct labor to take on some of the most pressing social issues, which should be part of a long-term strategy of research by more secure faculty. We also heard that fellowships might now be on the decline as a result of oversaturation. Here's Hans Tursack, Katie McDonald, and Curtis Roth.
One of the things that facilitates the kind of proliferation of schools that are producing excellent work is the fellowship thing. As tricky as it is, it's, you know, for the most part, they're 9-month contracts, usually really low paying, a lot of problems with the fellowships. They usually have really unclear sort of parameters for if they rehire you or not. Huge problems with that model. But at the same time, it's bringing different people who might not go to certain areas to those areas. It's spreading out ideas pretty quickly, ideas that might have at one time been like quarantined in a select group of schools.
One thing that's interesting about some of the positions we see coming out, like more of the fellowships, which are a common entry point to architectural academia, more of the fellowships are geared towards socially engaged practice over the last couple of years, but particularly after 2020. And one of the kind of difficult things about situating that work as a fellowship is that you're putting the onus of really tackling a difficult system on an adjunct faculty who might be there for a year, rather than, you know, really supporting the work in a long-term way with longer contract or permanent or tenure track faculty. So that's something that we've seen as an area of growth, but also as an area of concern, because really this work, if we're going to do it as a discipline, has to be done in a way that's sustainable over the long term.
When I got out of school, there were maybe two or three fellowships. And now I think there are probably 20 across the country. So like that as a kind of model of how one practices when they get out of school seems to have kind of exploded. And actually, I think maybe now has even collapsed within the last couple year or two. I think there's starting to be a kind of shortage of those things in a weird way. So if you look at that fellowship bubble, I think there were a series of projects that maybe kind of tried to tie together the work that was coming out of those processes. And the one that I know maybe the best, because I was at OSU as a fellow when it happened, was the Possible Mediums project. So like, I think that work was basically exhibiting a whole group of people who were in the process of doing those fellowships or had just finished those fellowships. And so in a way, that was it was a kind of highly mediatized collection of this new economy of teaching that had sort of emerged maybe even just like 5 or 6 years prior to that. Possible Mediums as a kind of project stands out as maybe one of the moments in which people who I wouldn't have thought about bringing together came together, and they came together around these very short kind of 1 year projects that they were developing, mostly in a kind of gallery context.
Roth mentions the Possible Mediums project, which we'll briefly discuss next. The project brought together a group of young academic practitioners to put a wide range of projects on the table in a notable moment of generational self-definition. It began as a conference co-organized between multiple Midwestern universities, but which took place at OSU in the form of workshops and lectures. It was later finalized as a series of essays and projects gathered in a book of the same name. Here's three of the four organizers, Christy Ballier, Kelly Baer, and Kyle Miller, on their experience organizing the project.
The Possible Mediums project, I think, started through a conversation of four faculty at four institutions, University of Kentucky, University of Michigan, Ohio State, and UIC. And as we moved towards wanting to set up a conference in order to have an expanded conversation, we quickly realized that what we wanted to accomplish was bigger than any one of our institutions could support. And so because we were all kind of junior faculty and for the most part tenure track faculty, we each had sort of a small pool of sort of research funds. You know, it varied per institution, but there was a bit of research funds that was earmarked for you at your own institution to do a symposium or a conference, as is usually the case. And so what we proposed to our four institutions was, could we pool those resources together to do a conference that would be hosted at one? It was ultimately hosted at the Knowlton School of Architecture at Ohio State, so it had a physical location, but it was a conference that was hosted by four faculty that represented four different institutions.
There was the kind of down and dirty aspect of producing work in this kind of work in progress format. But then there was also a sort of polished strata that kind of slid between that workshop model, which was kind of moderated discussions based on each of the themes that we had outlined for the conference, kind of medium specific themes. And then at the end, we called it a kind of science fair, where we roved around each of the, were there 16 workshops? Where definitely Jeff, I remember being there, but you know, where the kind of reading and then rereading of this work and also the kind of projection of this work could be kind of theorized in also a very, you know, loose and fairly, I would say that was a kind of informal, but we did try to kind of make this an academic event in the sense of, I think we each gave like a small lecture and moderated a panel on these themes. So there was this kind of like high level academic and kind of low level down and dirty production that were happening.
I often think now about how Possible Mediums kind of concluded that conversation when it became a book, maybe just like Matters of Sensation and Log 17 did for the generation before. Once it becomes that definitive, even though it was written in a way that meant to open things up, it kind of codifies and cements aspects of that conversation.
And here's Katie McDonald reflecting on the importance of Possible Mediums.
That project kind of marks a generation, and something that was interesting about Possible Mediums was even that struggled to find a way to kind of connect all those practices because they had different interests. But there were some that were interested in the digital, some that were interested in kind of like optics and techniques of representation, some that were material practices like Jennifer Bonner or Brandon Clifford or Team, but each kind of with different approaches to material. Yeah, so there are threads, there are different threads within there, but I think largely it was more focused on the discipline itself. And I think there's a shift to try to connect the discipline with the public in the new generation.
So far, we've discussed the academic figures and offices shared by this generation, as well as the shifting geography of academia as the job market tightened on the coasts and fellowships sprung up in the middle of the country. To conclude, we will turn to the projective, the post-critical, or the turn to practice, all names for debates that coincided with this cohort's time as students and young faculty. While these debates might be seen as taking place between the publication of Somel and Whiting's Notes on the Doppler Effect in 2002 and their guest-edited issue of Log in 2005, it had earlier roots and encompassed many other figures. Already in the mid-1990s, you could see a rejection of the critical stance of Eisenman by younger figures like Stan Allen and Sanford Quinter, and you could hear Rem Koolhaas saying that architecture could never be a critical practice. In Allen's article, Practice versus Project, from 2000, he argued that architects should shift from their prior focus on a hermeneutic practice involved with the interpretation of language, meaning, and signs to a material practice focused on the hard matter of architecture's own techniques and tools. Shortly after becoming dean at Princeton in 2002, Allen hired Sarah Whiting and brought Bob Somel, Sylvia Lavin, and Jeff Kipnis to teach seminars regularly in the school, such that Princeton became ground zero for projective discourse. But because Peter Eisenman was also teaching at Princeton in these years, the new projective discourse had a clear enemy, the critical discourse of Hayes and Eisenman. In this context, we can understand this generation as inheritors of a set of ideas about the end of criticism, the end of theory, the need to think through practice, the need to use architecture's formal language to engage with the world, to find performative effects for architectural techniques and material behaviors, and arguments to facilitate the power of matter and sensation to solicit emotions and even to project new lifestyles. Here's Kyle Reynolds, Stuart Hicks, and Michael Young on their experience of how exciting and liberating the projective debate was at Princeton in the years between 2003 and 2007.
Peter Eisenman was still at Princeton when I was there teaching design studios in the 10 canonical buildings class at the same time that Sarah Whiting and Bob Somel were teaching as well. So Sarah and Bob were my thesis advisors. And there was a definitive discussion about like the critical and projective kind of playing out in school at the time that I was in grad school. So I see that as kind of highly influential to me personally.
So at Princeton at the time, yes, the projective versus critical debate was central. So Bob Somel, you know, came and visited. Sylvia Lavin was there. At the same time, Stan Allen was kind of in the midst of his deanship and was bringing in young practices to teach. So like So Ill, Sejima came and taught, like a host of practices that wanted to be practices, which wasn't what Princeton did prior to that, really. Like, that was a shift, and we felt that. Sarah Whiting was there, you know, obviously arguing for the role of the projective and that sort of stuff. Obviously, I connected with that, the projective, because I sought out to teach with Bob. But that felt just so freeing at the time, where it almost felt like an excuse to be able to have fun with architecture. Like, it was like, you do something awesome, and we'll have your back. Like, that's kind of how it felt like as a theory position. Like, if it's awesome, we'll figure out a way to position it. It's kind of how I took it. It was like permission. It didn't need to hurt so much. Let's turn the conversation and just recognize when something's good, you know, like, let's just like not have to pick it apart in a way that just that crushes it or kills whatever happens.
I was involved with a lot of the discussions and seminars and studios that would lead into the issues in that book. Sarah Whiting and Bob Somel's post-critical notes on the Doppler effect, as brought by Stan into the school, became a kind of crucial debate, and it kind of focused around a little bit of trying to understand what was critical architecture and the differences between how that was played out by Peter Eisenman and Liz Diller being two very different examples of what criticality meant in architecture. And I don't think that Sarah or Bob would have necessarily understood the implications of that article, but the implications of that article reverberated and I think resonated with a whole number of people who were in a younger generation than I. And not that it's the founding moment, but it does have, I think, significant impact in leading to what was the article of indifference that Michael put together.
While Stuart Hicks, in particular, saw the projective position as highly liberating because it placed an emphasis on making work without overloading it in terms of what it was meant to mean or what critical function it would have, others who studied with Stan Allen and Sarah Whiting at Princeton or Rice felt pressured by the need to have a project. We will hear from Bryony Roberts, Michelle Chang, Jaffer Kolb, and Kyle Reynolds, who saw the injunction to articulate a project through practice as difficult because it required a degree of specialization and rigor in positioning one's project in a historical lineage and to be clear about what specific features of the discipline one was developing. Reynolds and Kolb both critiqued this mode of discursive production as artificially restrictive, and Reynolds went so far as to write the polemical text No Project in 2015, which critiqued this model of discursive positioning.
I would agree that we are the children of the post-critical generation. I think that's very accurate. I mean, one of the main messages that I got from that generation was that you communicate a position not necessarily by writing a book about, you know, a grand sweeping theory of everything, but by having a conceptual position in your practice. And the demand when I was in school was that that be super clear. You know, you always had to talk about your project, your conceptual project, not the actual design project. But you had to be able to articulate, you know, what was at stake? What were you claiming for the discipline through a combination of a kind of theoretical position and a design proposition? And that was very formative for me. I've certainly never been able to shake that expectation that that's how you should work.
The idea of the project was very, very heavy, and how to position the project very clearly in a way that you can summarize it became an exercise that I got used to.
The time we were writing it seemed to be like the peak of project making. But I think also a reaction to like the development of one's own project was at the expense of everything else. And so projects became more and more niche areas within the discipline that hadn't been touched or people could kind of identify and claim for their own at the expense of everything else and kind of walling off that kingdom and maybe not participating in conversations that might be adjacent to or surrounding it. And so that way of working was just not very interesting to us. I mean, it seemed to be extremely limiting in what you were able to work on or define, like it either fell within your project or not. The other thing that I think came out of it is it seemed like all of the good projects were already taken by the previous generation. And so we were left with like the scraps and, you know, we just didn't want to work on those pieces. And so the insistence on defining one's project, but then not being able to kind of participate in someone else's project that has already been claimed was something that we wanted to kind of react against.
The method through which I thought was a negational method. So I would think about something and reject it, and then think about something and reject it, and then like come up with a pile of rejected things. Like, oh, I'm not allowed to think about this. I'm not allowed to think about that. I'm not allowed to talk about the personal. I'm not allowed to talk about the emotional. I'm not allowed to talk about the significatory. I'm not allowed to talk about meaning. I'm not allowed to talk about semantics. I'm not allowed to talk about postmodernism. I'm not allowed to talk about symbolism. And it was just like a pile of knots. And what ended up on the other side was just nothing. And no one said, here's what you should think about. There were clearly things that people who were cool were interested in. It felt like a series of kind of implied fashionable choices about what was acceptable to think about and what wasn't acceptable. And I really reject that. And it took me many years to shake off. It took me like from 2013 to say 2017 to sort of like unlearn a lot of the messages from Princeton or that kind of, let's say metonymically, East Coast liberal elite institutions around academic disciplinarity. It took me a while to kind of like shake those and be like, oh, I would rather just make and have fun and explore.
This generation's varied responses to the post-critical debate raises questions about its impact on their practices and what role it plays within the changing context of academic production in the last two decades. John Lott describes the debate as allowing people to move past us versus them binary discourse.
Sarah and Bob had just written their piece, and Sarah was at the GSD. And so we were all kind of like, what do you mean, you know, the post-critical? And it really hit the student population with a little bit of a shock, had a little shock value to it. At least that's how I read how it landed in the school. Looking back, I think it was one of those tipping points which took us out of the oppositional approach and helped broaden the varied approaches that didn't need to pit one over the other.
McLean Clutter described the debate as something that was needed to move past the discursive dead end of Eisenminian autonomy.
It's interesting to me that we needed that moment on some level, like that the distance that we had created from the modernist project of architecture having a kind of social goal or being a diagram for life had grown to such an extent that what we needed to shake us out of the stubborn insistence to not engage or to engage only through resistance, through very intellectually and aesthetically beautiful and yet abstruse projects, was a kind of, in a way, equally abstruse project that was about a new form of engagement. I think we did need that, and we're all lucky to have it. But when I go back and think about the stuff that I taught at UIC, and when I got here too at Michigan, and I put myself into the headspace of thinking that I was teaching students about how to work on architecture as a way of engaging culture, like the techniques and that ambition don't square with me anymore.
Building on Clutter's diagnosis of the post-critical as a highly theoretical rejection of the highly theoretical, we could argue that a discourse which claimed to be turning towards practice and towards engagement with the world, but that encouraged students to develop a highly academic conception of practice as a project, in fact steered this generation towards academia rather than practice. Niran Taran saw how the projective discourse helped others move past certain conversations, but similar to Clutter, she didn't see it as having a lasting influence on her practice.
I do know that some of them were liberated from that discourse and found ways to go beyond. But I always had a kind of, again, uneasy relationship with this. It's very uniquely American, which is fine. I'm American. Like, I'm here and I'm American too. But at the same time, for me, when I arrived, I was aware of it. Maybe next year I found the article and it should be around the time I arrived. You know, either as a Harvard, I realized it, or at Yale. I don't remember when I first read it. I don't think it affected my thinking directly as some of the names that you mentioned. I actually found it very critical. Like, their writing was very critical. It was almost reactionary. It was almost like a generational reaction to a certain understanding of theory, or maybe an understanding of theory and practice. Because I worked with, I mean, Sarah was a dean in a school that I worked in. I also never felt that in her pedagogy or the way that she wanted to build the school was a post-critical, quote-unquote, pedagogy. It was very critical. But I don't think I ever had an influence of that discourse directly on my work. I think that it was really a reactionary thing at the time.
And we will close with two outright rejections of the post-critical. Here's Anna Niemark and Jaffer Kolb.
The intellectual project at the GSD when I was there was anti-intellectual. It was absolutely intellectual to say that let's get rid of criticism, let's get rid of theory. Post-critical position, I think, is what they would have called it. I refused to join any of that. I thought that it was really important, actually, to always have a critical position. I know that it's less productive. I know that sometimes it freezes one to maybe speak more and to produce less.
When I look at the post-critical, the post-theoretical, like the, you know, all of these things, I see a late capitalist exhaustion with the production of academic discourse. And I think that a lot of that writing came out of less about ideas and more about a drive to differentiate oneself from one's peers, becoming almost an Ouroboros. You know, it's hard to like think about the post-theoretical and the post-critical without just thinking about cannibalism. We've tried everything else to like advance ideas. We've tried everything else to come up with something new. The last thing we can do is basically start eating each other.
Niemark and Kolb call attention to an argument that prior interviewees have made implicitly, that the projective turn was productive, that in the simplest terms, it encouraged the production of work. We can understand this greasing of the wheels of academic architectural production in the context of an increasingly competitive and demanding academic job market, which requires highly differentiated, novel work. This generation's exposure to projective or post-critical discourse has a long shadow that will reach across the rest of this issue of attention. We'll see this generation's continued engagement with the discourse around practice manifest in their interest in stud framing, DIY construction, and architectural and construction labor in our episode on aesthetics. And in the episodes on politics and ideology, we'll revisit this group's language, which leans towards the pluralistic, and in which we can hear echoes of post-critical strategies of opening, broadening, permitting, and including. Members of this cohort consistently advocate for disciplinary expansion, audience inclusion, and design freedom, while rejecting oppositions and binary debates. We will also question the relationship between individual productivity and collective discourse. We'll ask what it means to be freed from the burden of theorizing or making arguments, and the relationship between academic discourse and the conditions of academic labor. In the next episode, we'll hear from this generation on their relationship to the digital through their rejection of the parametric, the rise of the internet, and the emergence of the post-digital. You've been listening to Attention, the audio journal for architecture, issue 8, talking about my generation. Interviews were conducted by Joseph Bedford between 2021 and 2022. The editing and production was by Tim Cox. Narration was written by Tim Cox and Joseph Bedford. Thanks to the Graham Foundation for advanced studies in the fine arts for their generous support. And thank you for listening.